This is June 5th, 2016, and I'm going to read from an article about aging, but it's more than about aging. And it's this is from the New York Times from April 30th of this year, and it's written by a Gerald Morzorati, who was a former editor of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Now, it starts off, and it'll may seem that it's really just aimed at the older of us, but I hope to show by the end that this is there's a lot more here than about aging and tennis. He begins, 60 is not the new 40. 50 isn't either. Your lung capacity in late middle age is in steady decline, as are the fast twitch muscle fibers that provide power and speed. Your heart capacity has been ebbing for decades. Your sight has been getting worse, your other senses too. And this, along with a gradually receding ability to integrate information you are absorbing and to then issue motor commands, means your balance is not what it used to be. And then he has in parentheses, your flattening arches aren't helping. Your prefrontal cortex, where the concentrating and deciding gets done, has been shrinking for some time, perhaps since you graduated from college. More of your career, more of your life, is behind you than in front of you. Do not kid yourself about this. You are milling in the anteroom of the aged. You can have something done with those sags and creases deepening on the face that greets you in the mirror each morning, but I'm not sure whom you are fooling. You can do the crossword and mind puzzles, stretch, take long walks. There is evidence that these activities correlate with keeping memory loss and, you know, death at bay for a while longer. 2, 4, 6 years, maybe. It's this first paragraph that really grabbed my attention when I read this article. I considered rereading it to see, for the sake of people whose denial of impermanence, denial of the decline of the body and the mind is still strong, but I think everyone got this. I've said it so often in Taisho, possibly the most powerful fuel for meditation practice, Zen practice, and enlightenment is the awareness of the impermanence, of transiency, of the flux that shows up in our mind and body just as it does in everything else. We read in the Vimalakirti Sutra, this body is like floating clouds that change and pass away in a moment. If the body is like that, how much more so the mind? And we see this when we're sitting, at least when we're sitting, how inconstant the mind is, how it just changes moment by moment. There's so much in the greater society of our culture that is suggesting to us that we can arrest this process of decline. We can slow it down for sure, and that's part of what he's talking about here. That'll be a little bit later. But to be really committed to spiritual practice means to accept the inevitability, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. Not just death, decline. He continues, let me suggest something that might do all of these things, which is to say, might not, but will, as nothing else will, provide you with a deeply satisfying sense of yourself that you did have when you were much, much younger. Find something, something new, something difficult to immerse yourself in and improve at. Probably I don't need to say that, suggest where I'm going with this in terms of practice as just that thing. He frames it in terms of tennis. When is the last time you improved at anything? I'm not talking about self-improvement, though I have nothing at all against turning to deep yogic breathing when your spouse irritates you. And he says, I'm not talking about self-improvement. This too is kind of settling for less than we can achieve through Zen practice. It's just going for self-improvement. Self-improvement is just somehow burnishing, improving the self. What Zen practice offers is a way to see into the very nature of the self, the illusory nature of the self, the way in which it both is and isn't. But self-improvement, yeah, that comes along with Zen practice. But it's nothing. We don't need to stop there. I'm just improving in all the ways that we know meditation now helps us. I'm talking about improving at a demanding skill or set of skills, a craft, a discipline. I have in mind something that will take years to get proficient at, something that there is a correct way of doing, handed down for generations or even ages, and for which there is no way for you to create shortcuts with your cleverness or charm. Playing the cello, maybe, or cabinetry, or in my case, tennis, serious tennis. Or, in our case, Zen practice. I took up tennis in my mid-50s. The nest was about to empty, and the weekend afternoons were beginning to yawn. I'd always been a tennis fan. With personal time on my hands and a career winding down, I wanted to do what? Something different and hard. Something that could counter the looming extended monotonies and unpromising everydayness I imagined awaited me in retirement. Here too, that is nothing we have to resign ourselves to if we have a vital practice, Zen practice, which enlivens everything. But I'll just continue. Something that did not transpire in my head and at a desk, which is exactly where most of our lives unfold these days. I wanted to learn and get better at something that embodied life. Embodied life. Let's put the emphasis on the embody. This is the difference between actual Zen practice and reading about it. Its real practice is in the body. The Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck has written extensively about what inhibits people from making a commitment to continuous improvement. School children, for instance, are often afraid of appearing to need to improve. I remember that. Afraid of appearing to need to improve, worrying that they will be perceived and judged as unintelligent, They struggle not to learn, but to seem smart, even plagiarizing and cheating if need be. Professional athletes, as Dweck has also observed, can lack the motivation and self-regulation required to get even better because they believe their inherent talent is plenty enough. Here's the blessing of late middle age, and there are few. You will not be inhibited from improving by the perception of others. No one is paying attention to you. Haven't you noticed? And unlike a pro athlete or master level practitioner, you will not be committing to anything, be it swimming or judo or open sea sailing. You won't be committing to anything that you have either any serious talent for or the body to get great at. You are not young, and learning and improving at a sport or activity will not make you feel young in any physical way. Of course, Zen practice will make you feel young in other ways. In fact, you will feel more consciously and intensely to be of a certain age, which I happen to think is a benefit. I have felt this, for instance, training at a tennis academy in Florida, immersed in the sort of regimen designed for 12 and 13-year-olds dreaming of scholarships to Division I schools. On the court, 4 or 5 hours a day in the heat and closeness, running back and forth along the baseline, catching and heaving a medicine ball tossed by a coach. I've hit ground strokes against the wall at my club in midwinter, attended tennis-specific plyometrics and TRX workouts, been beaten down by all manner of younger, better players in league play and at tournaments. But I improved as a result of all of it, and I am still improving. I have a much better backhand volley than I did this time last year. Is it really good, or even that good? Am I that good? No, I am 63, and I'm not really concerned about where all this winds up. It's the getting there I'm enthralled with. I think what's most impressive about this writer is simply his how alive and well his aspiration is to develop in some way, even though it's just developing a skill, a worldly skill, like playing tennis. But still there is this reaching to, all right, improve, develop. It's great what he's doing. How much better would it be if he were really working on the self, that is, working to see the nature of self and other, life and death. There's no evidence that tennis or any other particular physical skill will do much for you in that regard. But what is also impressive is he's got to have enough detachment from his ego to just be able to throw himself, be willing to throw himself into this situation. He's maybe the oldest guy in that whole clinic in Florida, and having all these young guys beating him. How wonderful that is. And it's almost poignant how close he is, but so far away. He's close by employing that resource of being willing to extend himself, to get beyond his limitations. That faith, it's faith in himself, faith that he can go further, and yet he harnesses it to an activity that for all you can say about it, is certainly not going to reveal the nature of life and death. And where he says, I'm not really concerned about where all this winds up, it's the getting there I'm enthralled with. This is great advice for in practice. If you can stop concerning yourself with the goal, if you can stop grasping at becoming something and just thoroughly lose yourself in the presence of effort and aspiration. He continues, there are quantifiable benefits often associated with taking up something like tennis and getting better at it. Your brain, its thought, will be recast and strengthened. This we know too. Every week there's a new study that comes out proclaiming the evidence of meditation and how it helps rewire your brain. Denise Park, a neuroscientist at the University of Texas at Dallas, randomly assigned more than 200 people to different new activities for roughly 15 hours a week and found that only those who had learned and refined a complicated skill improved their memories. Only those who had learned and refined a complicated skill improved their memories. Zazen can feel pretty complicated at first when you're learning it. You try to be aware of postural things and how to use the mind. Other researchers say the intense and prolonged physical exertion of a game like tennis may fend off cancer by slowing the decline of your telomeres, the tiny caps on the ends of your DNA strands that tend to shorten and fray with age and leave the DNA subject to greater risk of mutation during cell division and replication. You will, I am convinced, do good things for your heart. Senior Olympians have been found, on average, to have a cardiovascular fitness age 20 years less than their chronological age. So he's presenting all these benefits of taking up a physical activity and that you practice that in a sustained way over time. Great. But it's still such a meager way of using this body-mind that is human body-mind that is so rare and precious. He continues, but let's not get carried away. As the doctor and writer Jerome Groopman noted recently, quote, the genesis of aging is still a mystery. There may be many aspects to why it occurs and at what rate it occurs. There may be ways of increasing longevity, and for any one of us, they may work or not. Probably most of you know that one of the biggest factors is just genetic. That is, how long your parents and grandparents lived. If you are taking up tennis or something like tennis and committing to getting better at it to add years to your life, I wish you all the luck in the world. Just don't bet on it. I can promise that you will come to know yourself better. Isn't that what Montaigne said we were supposed to do later in life? I have learned over these past 7 or 8 years that I can deal with being humbled, but not humiliated, that my energy level is highest late in the afternoon, that I am more impatient even than I knew, that my left stride is longer than my right, which can aggravate balance problems, that I am harder on myself than on my opponents or doubles partners, that my hand-eye coordination is better when my right eye is doing the focusing, that I am a pretty good loser, and that I like being among others who love playing tennis. as much as I have come to love playing tennis itself. Okay, good. All these nice little things, learning that your stride is left, blah, 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 blah. It's interesting. Yeah, it's not entirely different from undergoing psychotherapy, where you learn things about your reactions to people and things, and you learn about the conditioning that you have brought into adulthood. These are useful. But it's still all about the self. This body-mind complex. What's beyond that? Who are we really? What is the self nature? Capital S self. He continues, to learn most of these things through struggling to improve, you will need the personal attention of a coach. You may have heard of the psychologist K. Anders Ericsson and the 10,000 hours of practice rule. It is often misconstrued a bit. The key is typically not the time you put in to get better, but the time you spend under the watchful eye of a coach, teacher, or trainer. Someone who can spot quickly what you're doing wrong and immediately correct it, or try to. I won't live long enough to have 10,000 hours to devote to personalized tennis training, but I have spent lots of time with a coach. There can be no improvement, not the kind I'm talking about, without that coaching. And this, I think, is largely true in Zen practice, too. Zen practice has always been a mentor-based practice. Zen monks in China, Japan, Korea practiced under a teacher. I always say at workshops that teachers can see with some objectivity, and certainly with a hell of a lot of experience, teachers can see how you may help yourself in your practice. Starting with just simple things, posture, the way you carry yourself, and beyond that, but a teacher can't help you much if you don't come to see him or her. If you don't reach out, how many people use the teacher? He continues, motivated to continue to develop, you will also learn to face and cope with all manner of a frustration. I think in particular of koan practice. One in particular is that continued improvement is not steady improvement. Back in the 1970s, an MIT graduate student named Howard Austin was awarded his doctoral degree for writing a mechanical analysis of the act of juggling. He found that learning and improving motor skills happens episodically. You get a little better, then regress. You have a sudden breakthrough, then backslide. He's talking about Zen practice, too. If you are my age, with my personality, this can be a recipe for despair. There just isn't the time to be writing reversals. Well, that's another thing that a Zen teacher can offer you, is to remind you that this is the way it is for all of us. You get a little better, then regress. You have a sudden breakthrough, then backslide. This is one of the most important things to bear in mind as you run into problems in practice and you find yourself less concentrated than you had been the previous day or the previous week. It's just to recognize that it's going to be that way. And not to be concerned about these ups and downs. I've sometimes used the example of climbing a tall mountain when I did a trek in the Himalayas to the base camp of Everest. I learned this, I embodied this by discovering that in the foothills and almost all the way after that, you don't just go up. It's not like an escalator, just continuous ascendance, but you go up a little and then you go down a little and then up again and then down a little bit and then up. But if you look at any little snapshot of say an hour or two, you may find yourself going down. But that's not how we want to look at practice. We want to take the big view, the broad view. And over time, there is a steady climbing effect, a steady improvement, development. The key is not to get caught in having the small view. He continues, time is the province of the young, yes? Which brings us to the beauty of a disciplined effort at improvement, and I think the only guaranteed benefit of finding something, as I found in tennis, to learn and commit to. You seize time and you make it yours. You counter the narrative of diminishment and loss with one of progress and bettering. You spend hours removed from the past, paren, there is so much of it now, and in a sense the present and all its attendant responsibilities and aches, and immerse yourself in the as yet. In this new pursuit of yours, practice is your practice. It comes to determine the way you eat and sleep and shape your days. It is not your life, but one of the lives that make up your life, and the only one for which looking ahead, at least for a little while longer, is something done without wistfulness or a flinch. Where he says here, referring to tennis, in this new pursuit of yours, practice is your practice. When he says, it is not your life, but one of the lives that make up your life, well, this is what distinguishes something like tennis or yoga, maybe, from Zen practice, which is all-encompassing. Our life is our practice. That's at least we want to make it our practice. Where is how do you separate life and practice? We want to bring this effort at awareness of being present into every moment of our waking life. That's practice. It's not just sitting. It's not just one of the lives that make up our life. It is life. There's one other article I want to read a couple paragraphs from that relates to what he referred to as mentorship. This is from Slate.com, the online magazine, and the article is called Spirit Guides. And the subtitle is, Students Crave Emotional Mentorship from Their Teachers That Their Parents Can't Give Them. There's nothing wrong with that. And this is by a William Dereshevitz. Nothing here about this Dereshevitz, except that this article was excerpted from Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. And he's talking about academic teachers and students. but we'll adapt it here. If you want a good education, you need to have good teachers. It seems ridiculous to have to say as much, but such is the state that matters have reached, both in academia and in the public conversation that surrounds it, that apparently we do need to say it. Between the long-term trend toward the use of adjuncts and other part-time faculty and the recent rush to online instruction, we seem to be deciding that we can do without teachers in college altogether, at least in any meaningful sense. But the kind of learning that college is for is simply not possible without them. Teaching is not an engineering problem. It's, of course, say the same thing about Zen teaching. It isn't a question of transferring a certain quantity of information from one brain to another. It's the same with Dokusan. Educate means lead forth. A teacher's job is to lead forth the powers that lie asleep within her students. To put it in the language of computers, you can download all the data you want, but it won't be any good to you unless you have the software to make use of it. That software, the ability to operate on information, to understand it, to synthesize it into new combinations, to discover and create with it, is what college is meant to, quote, install. But here the analogy breaks down, for unlike actual software, the installation isn't quick and easy, and it certainly isn't passive. You see here the link here with the article we just read about practicing under a coach, a tennis coach. Thinking is a skill, or rather a large and complex set of skills. In terms of what they take to learn, they aren't any different than manual ones, than hitting a ball or throwing a pot. You do not learn them from a book or video or website. You learn them directly from another person. Or not, let me just insert that. You can make good progress sitting on your own without access to a teacher. But you can make even better progress when you are working with a teacher. Again, these skills, you learn them through incessant repetition and incremental variation and extension under the close supervision of an experienced practitioner. You learn them in classes that are small enough to allow for individual attention, supplemented by one-on-one instruction tailored to your own specific aptitudes and needs. If you're learning how to play guitar, the teacher will place your hands exactly where they need to go and do it again and again until you get it right. The mind has, quote, hands as well, and an endless variety of things you can do with them. In class, you do not spend your time transcribing information, in class or the Zendo. The proponents of distance learning are not incorrect to believe that lectures are usually an inferior form of instruction. That is why a significant portion of classes, at least, should be small enough to run as seminars. The purpose of a seminar is to enable your professor to model and shape the mental skills she's trying to instill. She conducts a discussion about the material, but she doesn't simply let you talk. She keeps the conversation focused. She challenges assertions, poses follow-up questions, forces students to elaborate their one-word answers or clarify their vague ones. This is all what Dokusan can offer that just plain sitting or even Taisho can't. She draws out the timid and humbles the self-assured. She welcomes and encourages, but she also guides and pushes. She isn't there to answer questions, at least not for the most part. She's there to ask them. Some of those questions should be ones she doesn't know the answer to herself. Discussion in a seminar should be collaborative and open-ended, alive with serendipity and the energy of imminent discovery, a model, too, of how to think together. Or, we could say, in terms of Doksan, how to not think together, but how to respond together. I often, when I'm encouraging people to come to Doksan, even if they don't have a question or problem, I will say that things sometimes emerge in Doksan that neither of us could have expected. And skipping a few paragraphs here, he says that his years in the classroom have convinced me there are two things above all that students want from their professors. And the two things, he says, are what they really want is that their teachers challenge them and that they care about them. They don't want fun and games. They want the real thing. Then he says, what they want, in other words, is mentorship. I remember just how starved I was for that myself in college. I saw how starved my students were for validation, for correction, for, let's not be shy of saying it, parental figures other than their parents. Not only is there nothing wrong with that desire, it is a necessary part of growing up. Other cultures, Jewish, Indian, East Asian, with their veneration of the teacher, recognize as much. I'm reminded of after I'd been here for a few years practicing with Roshi Kaplow, how my mother took me to task, saying, "Boy, I don't know how your father, how he would feel about this with your how you're working so closely with." With Roshi Kaplow, I would like to think, though we never discussed it, my father and I would like to think that he would have had the wisdom to recognize that another mentor can offer me things that he couldn't, even though I felt extremely close to him emotionally, which cuts both ways. Parent, you'd think that a good parent would be able to let go enough to have the child practice or train or study with someone else. And then he says, in South Korea, so I'm told, parents warn their children that they don't stop misbehaving, they'll tell their teachers. But in America, we're not so sure. We are possessive of our kids, jealous of other influences upon them. But in The Path to Purpose, William Damon talks about the critical importance of outside adults in helping young people find their way. And Mark Edmondson remarks, while acknowledging the inevitable sadness for the parents who are left behind, that, quote, it almost seems the natural order of things that children will leave their families and strive to put themselves under the influence of other guides, more attuned to their rising hopes. I also remember hearing that Yasutani Roshi's had his son work with another Zen teacher other than himself. All kinds of reasons why that's helpful. All right, time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. Without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.